It is now my joy to introduce Reverend Marty Keller. This is a mighty short introduction for a lady who has given so many years to our Unitarian values. Reverend Marty Keller is a minister with the Unitarian Universalist Women's Federation. She has been a UU parish and community minister for 21 years. Prior to ordination, she was a journalist, cultural critic, and advocate on behalf of women and families. Reverend Keller recently completed 1 year as a consulting minister in Auburn, Alabama. She is a self-described Jewish UU. Marty is a past president of UUs for Jewish Awareness, co-editor of Jewish Voices in Unitarian Universalism, and former vice president of the board of the Society for Humanistic Judaism. Reverend Keller's sermon today is titled, Give Me Your Tired, Your Poor. Reverend Marty Keller, I do know your name.
Just a slight update on my bio. I was actually left the Unitarian Universalist Women's Federation in very good hands last year after 20 years serving on the board and funding panels and 6 years as their minister. So I'm hoping that a newer, younger blood of women, identified people, is going to be taking the reins, and I'm real excited for them. How many of you know the song Anna Tefka, Anna Tefka from Fiddler on the Roof? Well, I'm going to part sing it and part read it as the opening reading this morning. So, Anna Tefka, Anna Tefka, underfed, overworked, Anna Tefka, where else could Sabbath be so sweet? Anna Tefka, Anna Tefka, intimate, obstinate, Anna Tefka, where I know everyone I meet. Soon I'll be a stranger, you did great. Soon I'll be a stranger in a strange new place, searching for an old familiar face. From Anna Tefka, I belong in Anna Tefka. Tumble down, work a day, Anna Tefka, dear little village, little town of mine. Fiddler on the Roof, which opened in 1964, for almost 10 years was the longest running musical in Broadway history. It is so enduring in its appeal that it is still playing somewhere in the world every single day, more than any other show. This story about a family in flux between old religious and cultural traditions and new ways, in large part, the changing social norms for women around marriage has found a musical home in multiple cultures around the world. As one theater critic points out, each one of these cultures feeling the story is specifically about them. Fiddler has seen popular productions in Japan, in Thailand and the Netherlands, as well as in an all-black high school in Brooklyn at a time of enormous interracial tension there. Every one of these places saw themselves, their culture, in the story of Fiddler on the Roof. Everyone from opera legend Byron Terfel to the Temptations straight out of Motown have covered the familiar songs. So yes, this musical is a universal tale about families and societies and tradition, transition. But it's also a particular story about a particular place and a particular time. The pale of the settlement of Imperial Russia at the end of the 19th century, the turn of the 20th century, based on Tevye and his daughters and other tales by Yiddish writer Shalom Aleichem. The pale of the settlement, where millions of American Jewish people can trace their ancestry. How many of you Jewish people in the audience can trace your ancestry to there? Yes. A large territory of Tsarist Russia, where Jews were allowed to live throughout the 19th century until restrictions were majorly lifted after the Russian Revolution in 1917. The 1.5 million Jews that were confined within this territory and who were subjected to shifting, stringent anti-Jewish regulations that were periodically erased and then reimposed, made harsher. There was the forced 25-year inductions of Jewish males as young as 12. 25 years, Jewish boys as young as 12, where they were often coerced into being converted into Christianity. Jewish rights to lease land and keep taverns were rescinded, and the Pale of the Settlement itself was periodically just reduced in size, forcing immediate exodus of Jews from their centuries-old homes. Following one period of relaxation of restrictions under Tsar Alexander II, after his assassination in 1881, the persecution of the Jews escalated. Jews were barred from living in any village and the ownership of agricultural land. There were government-sanctioned pogroms. How many of you have heard of pogroms? From the Russian word meaning to destroy, to wreak havoc, to demolish violently, when peasant attackers looted Jewish stores and homes, destroyed their property, and raped their women, when many individuals were beaten and or murdered. The inspiration for these vicious attacks, the ideology of anti-Semitism, which we are told blamed the Jews exclusively for the weakened economic conditions and political instability there, in addition to the claim, the usual claim, the age-old claim, that the Jews murdered Jesus. Fiddler on the Roof is also the haunting story of this, the precarious scraping together of life under harrowing conditions in the fictional, underfed, overworked little town of Anatevka in the Ukraine. The constant presence of Russian Cossacks, the sudden, unexpected, unanticipated beatings and burnings, the forced departures, and it well could be the story of my family and my husband's family as well. It is the story of my father's father, Louis Greenberg, who was somehow allowed to leave Shepetovka, Ukraine, a Hasidic Jewish center where one of my great-grandfathers was a Rebbe, a holy man, to go study at a yeshiva, a Jewish learning center in Kiev. But his secondary school studies were cut short by a draft notice from the Russian army. That harsh, mandatory 25-year military conscription force, as I said before, disproportionately on Jewish young men. Faced with the draft notice, his parents located landsmen, or town folk, who had already immigrated to Boston to sponsor him. Louis worked for them as a tailor and was able to bring the rest of his family over before legal immigration was slowed to a trickle here in this country in the next decade. Those friends and neighbors who were left behind, who either could not or did not choose to leave, were all of them slaughtered in the Holocaust, 4,000 or more of them gone. It is also the story of my grandfather, Abraham Stein, orphaned by influenza. Both of his parents died at the age of 7 in Warsaw. Sent to be an indentured worker on a farm, leaving Poland ahead of more pogroms and more persecutions, able to get to London with his sister and then to the US to work in the textile industry, who founded a Jewish family in the unlikely place of Adams, Massachusetts, way up north near the border, whose multi-generational reunion I attended last summer. And it is the story of my husband's grandmother, Rose Berkowitz, who, when in the throes of advanced dementia, would wake up screaming about having been beaten, memories of a pogrom or pogroms in Romania, from which she escaped when her father got to Chicago, worked and saved enough money to bring his wife and his three daughters over to safety. But the memories persisted till the end of her life. It was not, however, the story of Emma Lazarus, the Jewish American poet, novelist, playwright, essayist, and humanitarian who wrote the sonnet, The New Colossus, whose words are engraved on a bronze plaque inside the entryway to the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. And I know some of you might even have memorized this and know this by heart, but it's just, listen, it is wrenching. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wrecked refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. But it was expressly for those Eastern European immigrants, those refugees from oppression and violence, that her bold words of universal welcome were penned, and for whom her brief life's work of liberation was dedicated. It was for the Greenbergs and the Steins and the Berkowitzes who made the journey across the Atlantic in steerage to safety, and through what one writer has described as, quote, the awful banging shut of the golden door, unquote. They arrived speaking only or mostly Yiddish. They took jobs as peddlers and tailors, launderers and produce sellers, whose grandchildren and great-grandchildren are now the teachers and the doctors and the social workers and the lawyers and the artists and the musicians and the business owners and the filmmakers and the mothers and the fathers and the Unitarian ministers three and four generations hence. Emma Lazarus, in contrast, born in the middle of the 19th century in New York City, was a fourth or maybe even fifth generation American, descended from some of the first Sephardic Jewish immigrants to arrive in what was once called New Amsterdam. Feared as, quote, hateful enemies and blasphemers of the name of Christ, unquote, by Peter Stuyvesant, remember him, the head of the, yeah, and potentially an economic burden on the colony, he wrote, they were only allowed to remain if they could prove they would not become a burden, but, quote, be supported by their own nation, unquote. Emma had heard the stories about the Spanish Inquisition and how the Jews first fled to what was then called the New World, to places like Brazil, which is where her family went. But by the time she was born in 1849, hers was a beyond comfortable and a very, very protected life. Now, here's some sort of dirt on her family. Are you ready to hear it? Because you know I always disclose the truth. I used to be a journalist, right? Her father, and they're good people, journalists. Her father was a rich sugar refiner who biographers tell us ranked among the founders of the Knickerbocker Club, the elite social club to which multiple Vanderbilts and Franklin Roosevelt would later belong. Her family owned a large home in the center of New York and a mansion in Newport, Rhode Island, and Emma received a classical education from private tutors. Now, how did this happen? Her immediate family, one literary historian discloses, was hardly known for its liberality. While relatives contributed to the Union cause during the Civil War, her family did not. While her father was not among the New Yorkers who gave money to support the Confederacy, his business, his sugar business, depended on what? The slave-owning economy of the American South. And his Louisiana business partner had been cited for abusing his slaves. This is Emma Lazarus's family of origin. Her father's wealth and connections enabled Emma to publish two volumes of poetry as a teenager, and she corresponded extensively with Unitarian Transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson, who she sought out as a mentor and a teacher. She traveled to Concord to meet him and others in his circle, like Ellery Channing, like the guy, the minister that Emily Dickinson wrote to for support of her poetry, and he devastated her, another Unitarian minister. This is a whole other sermon I will give at some point about her connections with Unitarian Universalism. Even as a young adult, she wrote prolifically. She wrote a novel about Goethe, essays, translations, some of her work winning international acclaim. But what was her journey from a largely indifferent and barely affiliated Jewish woman to where she ended up later in her life. Well, it was one of awakening, we are told, and it made me think about being woke. So she got woke. In the 1870s, when word began to come of anxious time for Jews in Germany, where there were increasingly anti-Semitic speeches and broadsides, and petitions to repeal newly granted civil rights, and on the streets of Berlin, Jews were mocked and assaulted, Emily began to get woke. In New York and other places in this country, where she learned stories of Jews being denied entry to hotels and clubs, Emma began to get woke. By the 1880s, she had learned of the miserable and terrifying plight of the Jews in Russia and the mass exodus that would follow, thousands each month, 1.5 million total. While she might well have been able to pass as an assimilated, protected Jew from an accepted old family, at a moment in America's social history when many Jews sidestepped or finessed their identity, as writer Esther Shore observes, Emma Lazarus got woke and declared herself to be Jewish. Having been exposed to Unitarianism and the emerging secular ethical culture society, she came to return to a progressive Judaism, whose teachings she saw as placing great importance on the just treatment of immigrants, with its sacred book, the Torah, commanding no less than 36 times the obligation to be concerned about the stranger in our midst. 32 times Jews are required to care for the stranger. Increasingly, her writing, including letters to and articles for major newspapers, reflected a more explicit Jewish affiliation with an overriding concern for the plight of that second and the third great wave of Jewish immigrants, whose religious practices and culture and fortunes had been embarrassing to her because they were so far different from her own. "Until this cloud passes," Lazarus wrote, "I have no thought, no passion, no desire, save for my own people." Emma's changing attitude, her embrace of the cause of just and humane treatment of immigrants, was not only evident in her writing. It was reflected in her work with and the financial support of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, which included visits to Schiff Refuge, which was a refugee camp on Ward's Island outside New York City. She taught these immigrants English. She trained them for jobs, and she found them employment. And then she advocated for them in the mainstream media. Emma Lazarus was 34 years old when she wrote The New Colossus, a sonnet of radical welcome. In 1883, as part of a fundraiser for installing the Statue of Liberty, to raise money, many well-known American writers, such as Mark Twain and Walt Whitman, were asked to write something. She is said to have said she was very reluctant to contribute anything to this effort. She nearly didn't. While at the time of her writing this famous poem on immigration, the gift from France to the United States of the Statue of Liberty had nothing to do with immigrants, Emma envisioned that huge woman bearing a torch in New York Harbor as the mother of all exiles, as watching for and over the newly arrived, offering them and all those to come an unequivocal welcome. Her poem was the only one chosen to be read during a large celebration to raise money for the pedestal. 3 years later, in 1886, the statue was packed up in 214 crates, shipped across the Atlantic, and installed. Very sadly, Emma died a year later at only 38 years old, from Hodgkin's disease. So she did not live to see her poem given a permanent home on the statue's pedestal 20 years after she wrote it. 20 years. Nor did she live to see her aspiration that, quote, "until all are free, none of us are free," unquote, come to pass. Scholars of Emma Lazarus' work and life differ about whether her fervent activism on behalf of refugees and immigrants was limited to the suffering of her fellow Jews. however different their background from her, or whether indeed, as biographer Esther Schor believes, Emma's bond and duty was to all who might be seeking safety and opportunity here. Was her interest only in Russian Jews because they were part of the Jewish tribe? Or was she really as universal as we'd like her to be? There is no indication, for example, that she ever spoke or wrote about the Chinese Exclusion Act, which happened during those same years that had more immediate impact on the far shore of the Pacific Ocean. But if the words of her famous poem bear proof, they say, "From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome." Worldwide welcome. This poem that on the occasion of the 50th birthday of the mounting of the Statue of Liberty was printed for the first time in school textbooks and children around the country were taught to recite it. This poem whose last five lines were set to music by songwriter Irving Berlin and sung on Broadway. This poem which still graces one of the world's most favorite statues with millions and millions of visitors every year. This poem, which has lately been used as a justification by those who would further limit the kind and number of immigrants who are allowed to squeeze through an ever narrowly opened golden door. By those members of the current administration who cynically speak only of the literal conditions that existed when Emma Lazarus wrote that poem. It is true that when Emma Lazarus wrote that poem, there was a work requirement, a sponsorship requirement for all refugees. That's the literal truth. It is literally true that at the time she wrote her poem in the part of the country she lived in, off Ellis Island, the majority of the people who came over were what? Europeans, Eastern Europeans. That is literally true. But what these people are missing is that Emma Lazarus' poem and her advocacy was always, always aspirational. Aspirational. It wasn't the what was. It still isn't the what was. But it's what should be and could be. It was a prophetic call, the call to take up the obligation to bring freedom to others. The Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society that Emma Lazarus worked with began with a mission to help refugees because these refugees, they were Jewish, when no one or almost no one else would give them any assistance. Today, this same organization, which is still called the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, continues to help refugees no matter what their religion, no matter what their ethnicity or what their nationality, because we are Jewish, they declare, and because protecting those who must flee persecution to save their lives is an outgrowth of the Jewish experience and reflection of Jewish values. The gunman who invaded and shot and murdered worshipers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh this past year did so, as much we know now, because he hated the fact the synagogue was supporting refugees as he hated Jewish people, and he hated Jewish people. He hated the fact that they were helping some of the 70 million people worldwide forced to leave their homes. He hated the synagogue people because they were fighting this administration's attempts to systematically dismantle America's refugee program and turn prejudice into policy. And for this, they died. Out of their shared belief in Tikkun Olam, which means repairing the world. Next weekend is the beginning of the High Holy Days in Judaism, one of the sources of our Unitarian Universalist living tradition. And undoubtedly, there will be rabbis reminding their congregants in this time of introspection and repentance of ways in which we, in ways in which they have missed the mark in furthering the commitment to welcoming the stranger as a core tenet of Jewish teaching and as a source of our living tradition of our teaching. Hear this, an Amidah, a ritual prayer for peace and justice in immigration, which was spoken by members of the Reconstructionist Rabbinic Association outside an immigrant processing center a couple of Rosh Hashanahs ago in order to draw attention to the plight of immigrants and to underscore the importance of the Jewish obligation to welcome the stranger. And I'm just going to read a little bit from it. So imagine these are rabbis, and it's the High Holy Days, and they're outside an immigrant detention center. They're not in a synagogue. They're there. God of our ancestors, God of immigrants, God of refugees, we are border crossers. We tie our fate with you who cannot be contained by customs offices. You who require no passport. You are the power that nurtures. You support the fallen. You free the captive. You give faith to those who sleep in the dust. Heal the suffering that causes people to flee their homes. Restore justice with love and compassion. Plant your help in every land. Lovingly accept our prayer. Osei Shalom. And in that spirit, we're going to sing Osei Shalom. Hopefully. We'll do it. We practice a bunch of times. Osei Shalom means bring us peace. Bring us peace. Osei Shalom. Okay.
May the one who makes peace up in the heavens make peace for all of us as well.
And that too.
Osei Shalom b'malam. Osei Shalom aleinu. Say shalom aleinu, hey, call Israel.
Beirut, amen. You know that one.
Say shalom, say shalom, shalom aleinu, Yahweh Israel. Say shalom, say shalom, shalom aleinu. Yasei shalom, yasei shalom, shalom aleinu, Echo Israel. Yasei shalom, yasei shalom, shalom aleinu, Echo Israel. Yasei shalom, yasei shalom, shalom aleinu, Echo Israel.
That's very good. So that's... yeah, maybe there probably was. Yeah. Right, absolutely. So discussion? Yeah.
I have to say, inviting me in touch with my somebody there. My four grandparents, I know exactly where they came from. They came over in the early part of the 20th century, I think. And my grandfather was a tailor that proceeded to bring over his family. My grandmother, his wife, and he came from Vilna. She came from the outskirts. And as I heard the story, her father was a land agent collecting the rents for the aristocracy, for the peasants. And there was a fire, and it was probably caused by
a pogrom.
My mother's mother came from a town about 60 miles from Vilna called Alita, and her father was a rabbi. My mother's father was, as my uncle would say, a half orphan. One of his parents died, and he came up very young with his mother, and he was from Minsk, the capital of Belarus.
The most surprising thing I learned about my grandfather Lewis is that he'd ever studied in a yeshiva, because what I knew of my grandpa, my papa, was him sitting in a chair reading the Jewish Forward, the Socialist Workers Party newspapers, and drinking tea with sugar in it. He was an atheist. I was like, what? That was the most surprising thing I learned about my grandpa. Yeah, so it was very, very other comments, discussion. Yes.
I just want to say, this is just kind of random, but about 5 years ago, here in Ellicott, the elementary school put on fiddler on the roof.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So,
yeah, right. It's all over. Yeah, it's all over. There's a new documentary that just came out that was Fiddler, Miracle of Miracles. I would recommend it. It really tells the story, and you can see a lot of the productions, and you can see how closely tied to the story of the shtetls and the pogroms it was, you know.
Yeah. Good question. When you said that the immigrants before, that they had to have work,
The requirements that are being proposed now about people seeking asylum, that in some ways you have to have some guarantee that they won't be a burden on the state.
Right.
That's been around forever in one form or another. There's been a few times, like right after the war, we were so embarrassed. If you remember the turning around of the boats full of Jewish people in the Havana Harbor in Miami, and just some of knowing what had happened during the war and how we didn't take the refugees. Under President Truman, there began to be some opening up, and it's just been closing and closing and closing. But it's true that for my relatives, it's clear that they had to have someone here who could say, we'll sort of vouch for them. But, you know, that's a pretty loose thing. And my husband and I were talking about, you know, there are so many billionaires around. They, you know, why can't they just set up a fund and say, you know, we'll vouch for these people. I mean, it's doable if you're not being mean-spirited, yeah. Which they are. Yes.
I find it interesting that Marty's family, Carl's family, my family, all share the same kind of situation. From Eastern Europe, it's interesting about tailors, because my grandfather was a tailor, and he was about to be conscripted into the Russian army. He did quality work, and he was being conscripted so he could make uniforms for the officers. And then he decided it was about time to leave. They came from Odessa.
Odessa.
But the similarities are incredible. They all came for the same purpose. They had to
go.
Go back. You know, I was rewatching for probably the 20th time, Godfather.
Yeah, we're talking about that.
And I was remembering that in my childhood, about one third of my friends were Italian American. And they had always had good feelings about Italy. And another third of my friends were Irish, and they had good feelings about Ireland. I have yet to meet a Jewish person who has good feelings about where he came from, because it was bad. You know? No, it's all I miss.
Really, got to go back.
I miss the ghetto. It's so fun.
Or the shtetl. Miss that guy. Yeah. Yeah, sure. They were refugees, like so many. They were refugees, yeah.
Well, my ancestors on the German side were Lutheran, and they came from Prussia for the exact same reason, to avoid conscription.
Yeah, it was true.
I'm really interested to know.
So,
I never heard anything good about Prussia.
Right, sure. I'm sure it did happen. I think the difference, and there's always quibbles about the stories, was that when they had a quota to fill, in a particular part of, then the Jewish boys were picked earlier, younger, and the quotas were higher. So that may have been a difference of whatever, but yeah, I'm sure they were conscripted, but there was always a little bit of something extra if you were happened to be.
I mean, maybe my ancestors were Jewish and I know.
Well, they could have been, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, those bagels, yeah. I know that are there any other elements of discussion before I turn it back over?